You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Michelle Hunnevin. Her first novel, Round Rock, has recently been published by Knopf. Now, I gather that this is a wonderful summation to years of work, and I'm wondering, because of the quality of the book, what it was that took so long for a first novel.
Well, the first novel is what took so long. I hate to tell you how long ago I started this book.
Tell me.
Well, I wrote a short story when I was 20, so I better not tell you how long ago that was, but it was 20-some years ago, and my writing teacher at the time said that this is not a short story, this is the chapter of a novel, and I tried for years to make it into a novel. I'd go back to it, I'd leave it alone, I'd try it again, and I did that on and off for 20 years, more or less, until I finally caught with something.
What was happening during those 20 years? I'm very interested because, you know, the act of writing a novel is fascinating to me, and what lets someone keep at it over such a protracted period is a really moving thing.
Well, actually, the novel is about growing up, and what happened in those 20 years was that I grew up to the point where I could write the novel.
How did you learn all the things that it took you to know to write this book? I'm very interested because the great joy is that this book has an extremely assured narrator. If the characters are fishing, she knows the bait, she knows the hook, she knows what they might eat by the riverside that will cause them to bloat. you know, there's an extraordinary assurance with the casual facticity of the everyday world.
Well, I'm a bit of a know-it-all. I love knowledge, and I love research, and I get infatuated with things, and that infatuation sort of makes learning about them painless. And also, I'm a generalist. I love learning about just about anything. So this is the result of this compulsion, this book that's full of fact.
Now, Round Rock is a book about a set of characters in a Southern Californian town north of Los Angeles who, in different ways, yes, learn to grow up. And in a certain way, it seems to me to be the satisfying fruition of the kind of Steinbeck novel of assorted, eccentric, well-meaning but difficult characters, the kind of thing in, say, Tortilla Flats. And it's a kind of novel that people seem to have forgotten how to write. I mean, this is the first one that I've read that does it successfully. It really is a lovable novel of misfits about whom one comes deeply to care. A, why do you suppose people have forgotten how to do this? And B, what is it that you think allowed you to succeed at it?
Well, thank you, Michael. I didn't set out to do it. I didn't set out to really do any one thing. And I don't really think I'm the only person doing it. I think that E. Annie Proulx does it. And I think that...
No, but E. Annie Proulx, for instance, is so full of catastrophe, sentence fragments. It is definitely this novel, but done in very dark postmodernist terms.
True. And Anne Tyler, I think, moves
to some
close
extent,
to
yes.
it, but her people always kind of snap back to their old lives in the end, somewhat expanded. And it's so interesting that you mentioned Steinbeck, because a few people have, including my editor. And I haven't read Steinbeck for years, but
me
I
either.
Would have to say that he was an incredibly formative influence on me in my adolescence, which is, of course, when you're so dilated to the world and when you really begin to read seriously. And Steinbeck is available to young readers, young adult readers, in a way that a lot of books aren't. So I'm just wondering if that wasn't the original seed that, you know, I started my novel career with one of my first literary influences. It wasn't conscious, but I don't doubt it.
It's interesting to me because it seems to me that when a writer is, say, in your word, a know-it-all, they're coming from one of two places if they're Americans. Melville, on the one hand, who's writing the great poetry, the epic mm-hmm. poetry of tools and jobs and occupation, or Steinbeck, who has the more journalistic approach to giving you as a reader the security of knowing that the author has somehow cared enough about the lives of the people to have learned how to have their experiences, yes? So this is the kind of writing of which experience is the great God. I'm wondering, can you talk about the kinds of shared experience you have with your characters here?
Well, I think that I have shared experience with them. I also was really taught to respect expertise and research while writing and to seek it out. And so that if I'm going to write about someone who repairs television sets, for example, I'll go to the library and read about the repair of television sets, and I'll talk to people that repair television sets because I don't presume to know about repairing television sets off the top of my head. Of course, another big influence on me was Mark Twain, who in his journalism, or in like Roughing It, he very painstakingly describes all sorts of things from silver mining to, oh, I don't know, Hawaiian crafts. You know, I want to give my characters jobs, and I want them to be proficient in their jobs. Uh-huh. And I think that also I had a teacher who really loved the kind of macho attention to tools and manly deeds. John Keeble, who's a writer up in eastern Washington.
He wrote Fish, didn't he?
Yellowfish, yes.
Yes, yeah, it's a nice book.
And he was extremely disciplined, and he was a big influence on me to make sure I knew my facts and to treasure facts and to treasure, you know, what goes into moving an engine or doing a ring job or something like that, that there's a lot of, you know, great human expertise involved.
Well, I'm glad you say this because this is a version of a macho novel.
I'm so glad you saw that.
No, the guy novel. It's so fun. Well, that's what I meant when I said that not many people are doing it because guys, by and large, have had it with that. Women have never, in a sense, wanted it. And so it's very interesting to hear that community locution coming out of a female broad speaker.
I was sort of raised as a writer by men, and I was raised on, I cut my teeth on really macho writers like Cormac McCarthy, and Tom McGuane is a huge influence, and I'm a big fan of his. You know, so
that's interesting. Who were your teachers, the other ones?
Well, let's see. There was John Keeble, and then I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where Lenny Michaels was there at the time, and Mary Lee Settle, and Vance Borghele. But the people that had the biggest influence on me, I think, were people that I read, and John Keeble.
Now tell me, what do you feel you learned at Iowa? Iowa, for my listeners' sake, most of whom I'm sure have heard this, was the first and the legendary writer's school for the very longest time. If you wanted to write a novel, you went to Iowa, and it was fabled for being able to help you along and this and that. And you went during its heyday, really. What did they teach you there?
Well, I had tremendous exposure to great writers living at the time. I mean, all sorts of people came through. John Cheever came through, John Irving, Ann Beatty, that poet, Richard Hugo. You know, just wonderful writers. There was a steady stream of them that you got to be exposed to and you got to party with. Larry Y. Woody, Ray Carver. I met all these people and talked to them and spent time with them and, you know, heard them read and heard the inflection of their voice. So that was the most valuable thing. As for the classroom work, it was a struggle and difficult and highly political. And I was very young at the time and didn't really have the apparatus for dealing with it emotionally that well. But it was a real eye-opener, the politics involved. I learned a lot about that, which is maybe inadvertent.
Now tell me, the thing that you seem to know best, at least on the evidence of Round Rock, about novel writing is building and revealing characters. Do you have any theories or rules for what constitutes a whole character? Because these characters do seem, as you come to know them, full.
Well, that's a good question, and not consciously, I don't think. And the curious thing is that none of these characters are based on a living human, per se. They're all, you know, amalgamations to some degree. I've given them specific things that belong to me or to people I know. But I've never based a character on another person. And if I had any theory in particular, it would be that, to sort of go beyond oneself and what one knows.
But, for instance, is it important to reveal a character incrementally? Because, for instance, what I noticed is that you would hear things about these characters. They're in a town that features a drunk farm named Round Rock, which in turn means that all these characters are going to have pasts they're trying to escape and presents that they're currently struggling in. This allows for surprise, because whatever a person is not necessarily what he's been. And it seemed to me that one of the ways that one builds a setting is three-dimensional. You foreground, middle ground, background, this makes a place. This is what seems to happen with these characters, too. There's a foreground, a middle ground, a background, and it gives them three dimensions, it seems to me. And it seems fairly conscious in every case that we're going to know what they're doing, what they've been doing, and what their childhoods were like.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess the way that I did it was I thought in terms of first impressions. Everybody has first impressions of all the other characters, and they tend to be fairly inaccurate. So some of the unpredictability and surprise is built on that. The first time Lewis sees Libby, he really thinks that she's trailer trash. And, you know, little do you know that 100 pages later, they'll be, you know, drifting towards love. And she's not trailer trash at all, but that's his first impression.
And he sees the trailer.
Yeah. And her first impression of him is no better. She thinks he's sort of a, you know, trespasser and fairly indigent, I think. I don't know. But nobody's very accurate about their initial assessments. And nor are people very accurate about their own self-assessments. That's the other sort of squelchy part.
Now, I want to talk about a particular scene because I found it very rich. It is the scene fishing by the river. And there's a brilliant piece of sleight of hand that occurs in it. I always like to speak to my listeners as if they are reading or have read the book. And so, no holds barred here, okay?
Okay.
The hero, Ray, is eating
chicharrones.
Yes. And they fill him up, and he thinks that he's having a heart attack. He's very, very frightened. And Libby, expert fisherman, offers him water, because what's happening is that the salt is causing his entire system to contract. Yes? And we think to ourselves, okay, he's out of danger. But of course, false alarm. But, of course, he is the character who dies in this book. And it's almost as if I'd ruled him out as a possibility for death because he had escaped it so narrowly. And I thought, what clever structuring to fool me with possible death only really to make me cry with an actual one.
Well, I thought it was some fairly obvious foreshadowing myself of the kind that you learn the first time you read Edgar Allan Poe story in high school.
Well, I'm very naive, as you know.
Well, I'm so thrilled that it worked in such a, you know, in such capacity. That's good.
Now, but there at that scene, Ray's son is there too. He's impressed by Libby, and it's partially the fact that the boy, the product of a divorce, marriage, is impressed by Libby, that makes Ray feel safe with her. But it's her proficiency that makes the boy very shy, in turn, about fishing in public. The scene seems to have a lot of functions beside the foreshadowing. And what I found very impressive here is that a lot of those writers who try to write this kind of book, and to my mind fail, write scenes in which one thing is happening at a time. This, and then another scene for that, and another scene for that. Take it slow. Don't tell too much at once. But this has all sorts of angles and glints and roundness. And I assume that 20 years gives you a certain amount of perspective, but please tell me how.
Well, I think that some of it is that it took 20 years to, you know, think up all of these things. But also you're talking in terms of scenes, whereas I write in terms of paragraphs, and that, you know, a paragraph not only has to attach to the paragraph before it and the paragraph after it, but something has to happen in the paragraph, and it needs to move. And so I think that because I work in smaller increments, that that's one of the things that happens, is that more happens in a scene. But also that is one of the that's one of the great turning point scenes of the book, because it's where Red actually, it comes into his consciousness that he is in love with Libby, or is falling in love, or could fall in love with Libby. It's sort of where you see from the outside that Libby and Lewis are kind of in serious trouble. And you see Libby's appeal and her friendliness, too, in a sense, in a public context that you haven't before. So there were actually a lot of things I was setting out to do there.
I'm speaking to Michelle Hunnevin, the author of Round Rock. It's her first novel. Now, in the time it took to write Round Rock, I would assume that a lot of other projects emerged and subsided, and that these are what you'll be turning to next? Is that how it works?
Well, I think that's absolutely how it does. I had actually given up fiction writing for about 6 years, and I went to seminary. And I was two years in seminary in a 3-year program, and I got an idea for another novel. So the second finals were over, I decided to start writing again, and I didn't want to start writing after 6 years on a new piece because I knew I would be just awful. So I thought, I'll dust off this old novel that I've been trying to write ever since I was 20 and, you know, get my chops up and see if there's anything there as well. And 3.5 years later, I had a finished book. And so now I'm going back to write the novel that I wanted to write.
The novel of seminary
life? Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Is it going more quickly than Round Rock did? I mean, has this given you a burst of confidence?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I think, oh, I can write a novel. And then on the other hand, I think, yeah, but it took me 20 years. And also, people are very generous with a first novel, and they're a little bit sterner, I think, about a second novel. So there's the attendant pressures of a first novel. Can I get it done? Will it be any good? You know, those are the unknowns there. The second novel is, oh, my God, will it live up to the promise of the first novel? Will it be too different? Will it be too similar? There's a whole new batch of anxieties.
But I would think that this is almost an ideal case, because reading this book, it's the kind of book that I forgot that I like. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't until I was in it, I said, well, really, this is quite good. And some part of me that likes things more coiled, newer fangled, wilder, experimental, some part of me relaxed and just sort of dipped into these characters and these situations. And I would imagine many of the reviewers felt similarly, that they were rediscovering the pleasures of naturalistic psychological narration, and that discovering, you know, the old argument used to be that you couldn't do it anymore because everything in it had been done.
Well, Michael, the process you describe is the exact same process that I went through. I set out to write an edgy postmodern novel.
That's, really?
I did, and I was so ashamed that there was this story and that there was this narration and there was this coziness to it. I really was, and it's so much so that I wrote kind of an entire other novel that sat on top of it. The first draft of this book was 730 pages with hundreds of pages more of interior monologue. And I sent it to the woman who had become my agent, and she just said, I can't read this. You've got to cut it in half. And when I cut it in half, what was left was this naturalistic, character-driven, cozy book that, you know, I had to give in and enjoy it, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I did.
Well, it does. I mean, all of the old saws about writing, you know, I had the feeling that the author of this book couldn't wait to get back to find out what her characters were doing. Is that true? You're nodding vociferously, yes.
Well, yes.
This is radio.
You know, I mean, I hate to admit it, because I always sort of cringed when those, you know, authors would say, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning to find out what my characters would do next. And I always think, oh, please. And I always kind of knew what they would do next, but I think the delight was in how they did it, you know.
Well, it really is. The Barry Hanna comment on the book seemed to me to be the best one, and I'm going to read it. He says, I've not read so knowing and pleasant a book in years. I stopped often in the reading to wonder, how can she be this absolutely aware, and how can she give such a beautiful damn about us, men and women, to our small, ardent struggles? Superb. Now, did you jump up and down when you got that?
I did. I literally jumped up and down. I also think it's the best piece of writing in and around the entire book. I'm such a big Barry Hanna fan. He's another sort of macho one.
Yeah, no, but it is a beautiful sentence.
It is.
I mean, you know, how can she give such a beautiful damn about it? That is, in fact, very close to my feeling. How nice to have an author care so much about the flutterings of hard emotion that we're afraid of.
I only wish I cared as much in real life. You know, I wish I were as, like, generous as I seem to come across in this book. It's a struggle to me.
Well, tell me, but that is the question. Is this an act? I mean, where does this come from?
I think in your books you can be on your best behavior. Nobody's stopping you.
Should you be? I mean, you and I both know the same things, you know, about writing. I mean, should an author be generous and on best behavior? It certainly does create almost a courtly relation between you and the reader. And I would say that the reader looks to the writer of this book the way the young man Lewis looks to Red.
Mm-hmm.
There's a charisma of this kind of generosity.
Well, it is fiction, you know. I wouldn't want to divorce myself from that too far. It's some of the so-called generosity of the novel is something that I struggle with a lot and I work towards. And I also didn't want to be saccharine about it, even in the book.
No, it's not a saccharine book. That's generosity is of a different order entirely, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, no, I didn't want my characters to be too good. And, you know, Red is not, he's far from perfect. He's a troubled human being. He's had a lot of difficulty with his sub-addictions after he gets rid of alcohol and a lot of trouble having close relationships with anybody. And
you just made me realize what I've been thinking, that this is a sort of latter-day Camelot, that Round Rock becomes a place, and we've got the Mort d'Arthur at the center of it, and a young adept who is in training, and there's, you know, a Morgan Le Fay and a Guinevere, that there's a certain amount of King Arthur.
Isn't
about
that funny?
This.
I never thought of that either.
But do you see it?
I do. When you say it, it gives me sort of goosebumps.
I mean, because it's so perfect in a way. This is the reinstating of an old morality involving truth-telling and certain steps that the characters take in their 12-step program that I mean, it really is. I never thought of it before.
On the other hand, you know, the characters may get better, but they don't get well. You know, Lewis may be a better friend, but he still can't be there for that moment like when Libby actually gives birth. You know, he can't quite make it to the finish line still.
Well, I hasten to remind you that Guinevere is not a faithful queen, that Arthur is not an untroubled man, and that Camelot burns down finally. Mm-hmm. That these novels of idealism, if they're any good, are about the defeat of, the mm-hmm. poignant defeat of idealism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you tempted to bring things to a darker conclusion? Because this remains a sunny book, and as anyone who spent time around alcoholics and addicts knows, the majority do not come around as nicely as one would hope and dream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that the subject of my novel was sort of William James's idea of the twice-born person, and so I wanted to write about that.
In the varieties of religious experience?
Uh-huh. That there are people who, you know, tumble into the abyss and manage to somehow find a branch or a twig to pull themselves back out on. And that was the subject of this novel. And it wasn't about someone who, you know, pulls a branch and almost gets out and tumbles back in, or gets out and falls back in. I wanted to sort of explore what that sort of second birth is and what it means.
So the precondition of the novel is that these people, you are looking at people who have been successful at reclaiming themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's the given.
That was the subject of the book for me, to some degree. People whose lives had been shipwrecked, but who had managed to find something to keep them afloat. And what that was, you know, varies from character to character. I mean, I think the character of Billy Fitzgerald, I think she was as shipwrecked as anybody else, and that her piece of flotsam isn't a particularly good piece of flotsam, and ultimately doesn't, I don't think, give her as rich a life as she would like to have, although who's the judge of that?
I've been speaking to Michelle Hunnevin. The subject has been her first novel, Round Rock, published recently by Knopf. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse, what time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.